What are the ethical and legal guidelines for practicing psychologists? Let's go to the bench.
The latest in legal news and information from Collins & Lacey, a leading South Carolina defense firm for construction, workers' comp, hospitality, retail, trucking, professional liability, mediation, corporate, government, and business law. This is The Legal Bench.
And welcome to The Legal Bench. I'm Michael Burney, Director of Business Development at Collins & Lacey Law Firm. Licensed professionals have ethical and legal guidelines for their specialty line of work. And with me today is our attorney, Robert Peel, and his special guest. Rob has been practicing law in South Carolina for more than 10 years and chairs our professional liability practice group here at Collins & Lacey in Columbia. Today, Rob's guest helps us understand professional conduct in a very interesting field.
I would like to go ahead and introduce and thank Dr. Shirley Vickery for joining us today. Dr. Shirley Vickery is the chair of the South Carolina Board of Examiners for Psychology and has been a licensed psychologist since 1988. This is her second time serving on the board, and she has served terms as chair during both of those terms. Dr. Vickery has also served as the president of the South Carolina Psychological Association and president of the South Carolina Association of School Psychologists. She obtained her PhD in school psychology from the University of South Carolina and has worked her entire career in this field. Dr. Vickery, thank you for joining us. And as chairperson for the Board of Examiners, tell us the role the board takes in your profession.
Thank you, Rob, so much for having me. And I appreciate the chance to talk about this. You know, the Board of Examiners is really a different kind of organization than a professional organization. We as professionals join professional organizations to gain information in our field, to get continuing education, to make professional friendships and relationships with colleagues so that we actually better our practice. But the Board of Examiners actually comes at it from a different side. We really are representing the interests of the public in making sure that professionals are appropriately licensed, that their training is fitting to the things that they're doing, and that their practice meets the guidelines and specifications of our law and regulations in South Carolina. So we really take the side of looking at whether the public is getting good service.
Well, that's great. I know that every profession has several factors which regulate them. What are these aspects for psychologists?
Well, we do have our statute that spells out all the things that psychologists need to know about practice. It actually defines the scope of practice for a psychologist. Scope of practice meaning what can a psychologist do? What are those things that psychologists are allowed to do as part of their practice? It defines what the criteria are, what kind of training a psychologist has to have. We have the code of law, the statute, and then the regulations, which actually give us a good bit more information about supervising other people in our profession, about what to do about records and psychological records, about things like confidentiality and how do you handle those kinds of things. We also have an ethical code that actually our state, in our statute and regulations, we've adopted the ethical code of the American Psychological Association, which is the primary organization nationwide that is a professional organization for psychologists but has developed an ethical code. So there's a fair amount of stuff out there that psychologists need to know about. And, you know, these are very long, wordy documents. They're not things that we can memorize. So really we ask that people in our profession know where these things are, know how to find them, have a hard copy if they need to have a hard copy, but just know that these are the sources that tell us what we need to do as practitioners.
Do psychologists have continuing education requirements where they are updated on new statutes or ethical issues? How do they learn about changes in the principles, the ethical standards, and the rules and regulations?
Psychologists are required to have continuing education credits. And as part of our renewal practice with the Department of Labor Licensing and Regulation, psychologists are required to get 24 continuing education credits every 2 years. Those credits can be in a couple of different specific areas. There's actually not in South Carolina, there's not a requirement that psychologists include ethics as a piece of that. This is a little bit surprising. Some states and jurisdictions do have requirements for specific ethical training every year or every 2 years. In South Carolina, we don't have that. So actually, by attending meetings like our South Carolina Psychological Association, I'll actually be going to their meeting in the next couple of weeks, and we'll have a session where we talk to psychologists in the state about changes in our practices and the board and things like that. So really, psychologists should be getting involved with their state associations. That's where they'll learn those things.
In your experience, being on the Board of Examiners for Psychologists, when complaints are made against psychologists, is it typically the brand new green psychologists, or is it the older ones that are more prone to make mistakes?
This is really an interesting question, I think, Rob, because it does not tend to be the brand new psychologists as much as it is those of us who are somewhat more experienced. And this is borne out in the data nationwide, too. I guess it's related to the fact that we get a little more comfortable and maybe start to drift a little bit from some of the things we've learned as we get older. And really, people in their 50s are more prone to making practice mistakes than are young folks. Now, we do see some errors that younger people make, and sometimes younger people make errors because they didn't know to look in the statute and regs. And, you know, that's actually one of the things we do as board members when we're about to license a new psychologist. We do an oral examination with that person. That's really kind of a different requirement in our field from a lot of fields. But the focus of that oral examination is the statute, regs, ethical code. I ask them when they do that to bring it, have it in hard copy, mark it up, look at it while we're talking, because this is not something, again, not something you memorize. It's something that you should know where to find the stuff in it. But I think part of what goes on with older practitioners or people who are a little bit more experienced is sometimes they just drift a little bit and forget that they need to go back to those basics.
And what are some examples of mistakes that are brought to the board's attention where a citizen has lodged a complaint against a psychologist? What are some of the more, I want to say, almost unfortunate examples that you have run across?
You know, I'll start out by sort of saying something else. Psychologists are really, in general, a pretty high-functioning group in terms of knowing the ethics and understanding how they need to practice. Complaints against psychologists are not as frequent as they are against a number of other professionals. And so I'm pretty proud of that. It means that, excuse me, along the way, we have done good training with psychologists in learning how to practice. But when we find mistakes, we find them in a couple of different areas, I guess. Sometimes it's competence issues. In other words, did the person really know this area? Should they have been practicing in that area? Or are they bleeding over into something they really don't know anything about? Sometimes it's something as simple as practicing without a license. And this is a little complicated in mental health-related fields because there are some exceptions. And I don't think this is true in certain other fields like law, for instance. People would have to be credentialed the same way, whether they were working in a state office building or a private practice. It's not quite the same for psychologists because there are exceptions in our statute that allow folks to practice in certain situations without actually having a license. So that confuses some people, and knowing the limits of that is something we do run into a fair amount. And that, again, means that you didn't really understand the law. We're also seeing, you know, right now there's, and I know you guys are aware that telehealth and telepsychology has just changed the whole field during this time of the pandemic. And how does one practice ethically during this time? What specific things do you need to pay attention to with doing therapy in a virtual setting as opposed to a face-to-face setting?
Yeah, we kind of see that in our practice of law as well. We'll get on a Zoom deposition and we aren't allowed to meet in person with the deponent. And it's different. I mean, you can tell people's body mannerisms, you know, whether they're being honest and that sort of thing. So I agree that the pandemic has made the virtual part of it a little more complicated.
You know, one of the things that a lot of psychologists participate in doing some kind of or provide a service called assessments, psychological assessments. And some of the tools that we use for those things are not really designed to be used in a virtual setting. Some of them are, you know, now that we all wear masks everywhere we go, and if we're around anyone else, we're wearing a mask. Some of our tools are not designed to be used wearing masks because you can't see the person's facial expressions and you're not always sure that they're understanding your words correctly. So, you know, I'm really interested in what that means for the practice of psychology as we move on into the future. How long do we continue to wear a mask? How do we as psychologists interpret our data? Are our licensees being accurate to members of the public when they talk to them about data, when they've done an evaluation and it's been done under non-standard conditions?
All right. What is unique with the nature of many people psychologists see in their practices?
We rarely see people when they're really doing well. Most of the time when psychologists see someone, it's because there's some stressor or there's some concern. And it can be a very significant thing. Let's say that a family is really concerned about their child who's having lots of problems and, you know, behavioral issues within the home or something's going wrong. Or a person has had a brain injury and needs to figure out how to cope with that. That's a very stressful event. Or, you know, folks who have custody issues, which I'm sure many of your lawyers are familiar with that too. What a stressful time that is. Psychologists get involved in those kinds of situations too.
How do psychologists get away from all of the mental stressors they have to listen to and process on a day-to-day basis?
This is a real challenge for a lot of practitioners, and it is important. And we talk to folks about this as we're working with them, both in the board and in professional organizations, about the importance of knowing the limits of what you can do. Because if you're working in your field, whatever it is, and you have folks you're seeing the entire day, how long can you really go and continue to be available and really engage with that person and do your best? If you allow yourself to see more patients, more clients, then you really have the energy and the skill to do, then you could really be creating some difficulties for yourself. So self-care is super important. We expect people to join professional organizations, to have colleagues that they talk with. And, you know, one of the best pieces of advice I ever heard from in a professional organization one time was someone, I think it was the president of the American Psychological Association, actually said, "We all need to have somebody that we trust enough to tell us when we're really falling apart or we're really having problems. We need to say to that person, please tell me this and I will believe you when you say that."
With all that you've shared, what issues do you see becoming from the board? I know you've mentioned practice practicing without a license.
Mm-hmm.
And the telepsychology, are there any others that are coming up in front of the board in the past couple of years?
What happens with psychologists when a complaint is lodged against them is with our state agency, the Department of Labor Licensing and Regulation, that complaint comes in to the board office, and then it's assigned an investigator. And this is a really helpful thing to the board because we will see, the board members will not see exactly who the complaint is against, but we'll see the kinds of topics that are involved. And many times it's surprising, the topics are simple things like just not supplying records in a timely fashion or not making it clear what the financial obligations are for the client who is seeing the psychologist. Those things are really pretty easy to work out. They're things that we expect that psychologists will be very clear with their clients about. But when those things don't go well, they do result in complaints more frequently than you would think.
What is the procedure that a psychologist should follow should they have a complaint lodged against them? And what's the process for investigating the claim?
When a complaint comes in, the psychologist will be notified by the board office. It will not actually be me personally, because I will not know that a complaint is lodged against an individual. None of the board members will know that. It's all confidential. But it does come into the office at LLR, and an investigator will be assigned. The psychologist will be notified that a complaint has been lodged against them, and they'll be asked for records. They should supply their records to the board office because that is one of the places where they really are obligated to share their records. And they should cooperate with the things the investigator asked them to do. Now, the investigation, as you can imagine, would be different based on what the complaint is about. And many times those things are resolved without coming to a hearing before the board. If the issues aren't, and I guess I kind of hinted at this a minute ago, too. Sometimes folks are upset when they see psychologists, and especially in situations like custody evaluations. Not everyone is going to get the result from that they wish for. So we find that some of the complaints that are lodged against psychologists are not founded and a hearing is not needed. But when a hearing is needed, the hearing normally takes place before the entire board. That will take a while before it gets to that point, because there is a process of investigation, and then some complaints are either resolved in some other fashion or are dropped before coming to a hearing.
What are the best strategies for psychologists to stay on the right side of the regulation and ethics part of their governing bodies?
The things I've said before really just are the basics. Have that statute and regs someplace where you can find it. Be sure that ever so frequently you reread the sections, especially sections that, if you're a psychologist practicing now, you need to know which ones of those things particularly apply to your practice. Things like supervision of other people who work in your practice. Mark that area up and reread it ever so often so that you're making sure you're following the letter of those laws. In addition, join your professional association. The people who do the best in terms of ethical practice are those people who actually make relationships within their professional association. They don't just go and maybe, go out to the beach and have a nice afternoon instead of going to sessions or get their continuing ed, but they invest in the association and make relationships, have colleagues that they can talk to things about, because really they're not as many psychologists in most areas as there are many other professionals. We have 900 licensed psychologists in South Carolina, but I don't think most of them actually live here. I think there are a number of folks who are, maybe come in and out of the state sometimes and do particular projects. But it means that many of us don't, we really have to look for people to make relationships with so we have someone to ask advice of.
Well, Dr. Vickery, thank you for talking to me today. I really appreciate it. I feel like I've learned a lot.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you so much, Rob, for giving me this chance.
Well, we want to thank Dr. Shirley Vickery for educating us today on the professional conduct for psychologists, and Collins and Lacey professional liability attorney Robert Peel for his questions. For more legal information of interest to South Carolina businesses, join us right here for the next episode of The Legal Bench.
You've been listening to The Legal Bench from the South Carolina defense firm Collins and Lacey. Learn more at collinsandlacey.com.